Sarah. Wait on thy end.
Hear now the words. Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
This is show number 72, comprising chapters 25, 26, and 27 of When the World Shook by H. Rider Haggard, and a note by Bickley, which is numbered 28 in the table of contents but not in the text. This is, for sure, the thrilling climax and conclusion of this novel. Manages to be thrilling despite the long philosophical discourse with which it sort of trails off, which won't be too much of a surprise to those of you who have been following along all this time. Other than that, we have new and startling departures in geoscience, including what seems to be a case of planetary diverticulosis, and a quite unexpected explanation for pole reversal. Oro continues to steadfastly refuse to consider whether, having destroyed half the world once and been unhappy with the outcome, he ought to expect any different results from doing it again. There's a modest amount of actual foreshadowing in the usual literary sense, and the terms right-hand and left-hand path are used in a quite different sense from the occult one, which we might have anticipated, given some of the background earlier in the book. Anyway, you can join me in about 10 hours on Twitch for my continuing live reading of A Princess of Mars by Edgar Rice Burroughs, and that is what we are going to pick up with on Monday. Chapter 25. Sacrifice. The air in this place must be charged with some form of electricity, but the odd thing is that it does not seem to harm us, said Bickley, in a matter-of-fact fashion, as though he were determined not to be astonished. To me it looks more like marsh fires or St. Elmo lights, though how these can be where there is no vapor I do not know, I answered. As I spoke, a particularly large ball of flame fell from above. It resembled a shooting star or a meteor more than anything else that I had ever seen, and made me wonder whether we were not perhaps standing beneath some inky unseen sky. Next moment I forgot such speculations, for in its blue light, which made him terrible and ghastly, I perceived Oro standing in front of us, clad in a long cloak.
"Dear me," said Baston. "He looks just like the devil, doesn't he? And now I come to think of it, this isn't at all a bad imitation of hell."
"How do you know it is an imitation?" asked Bickley.
"Because, whatever might be the case with you, Bickley, if it were, the Lady Iva and I should not be here."
Even then I could not help smiling at this repartee, but the argument went no further, for Oro held up his hand, and Iva bent the knee in greeting to him.
"So you have come, all of you," he said. I thought that perhaps there were one or two who would not find courage to ride the flying stone. I am glad that it is not so, since otherwise he who had shown himself a coward should have had no share in the rule of that new world which is to be. Therefore I chose yonder road, that it might test you.
Then if you will be so good as to choose another for us to return by, I shall be much obliged to you, Oro, said Baston.
How do you not know that if I did it would not be more terrible, preacher? How do you know indeed that this is not your last journey from which there is no return?
Of course I can't be sure of anything, Oro, but I think the question is one which you might more appropriately put to yourself. According to your own showing, you are now extremely old, and therefore your end is likely to come any moment. Of course, however, if it did, you would have one more journey to make, but it wouldn't be polite for me to say in what direction.
Oro heard, and his splendid icy face was twisted with sudden rage. Remembering the scene in the temple where he had groveled before his god, uttering agonized, unanswered prayers for added days, I understood the reason of his wrath. It was so great that I feared lest he should kill Baston, who, only a few hours before, be it remembered, had tried to kill him, then and there, as doubtless he could have done if he wished. Fortunately, if he felt it, the impulse passed.
"Miserable fool," he said.
I warn you to keep a watch upon your words. Yesterday you would have slain me with your toy. Today you stab me with your ill-omened tongue. Be fearful, lest I silence it forever.
I am not in the least fearful, Oro, since I am sure that you can't hurt me at all any more than I could hurt you last night, because, you see, it wasn't permitted. When the time comes for me to die, I shall go, but you will have nothing to do with that. To tell the truth, I am very sorry for you, as with all your greatness your soul is of the earth, earthy, also sensual and devilish, as the apostle said, and I am afraid very malignant, and you will have a great deal to answer for shortly. Yours won't be a happy deathbed, Oro, because, you see, you glory in your sins and don't know what repentance means.
I must add that when I heard these words I was filled with the most unbounded admiration for Baston's fearless courage, which enabled him thus to beard this super-tyrant in his den. So indeed were we all, for I read it in Iva's face, and heard Bickley mutter, "Bravo! Splendid! After all, there is something in faith." Even Oro appreciated it, with his intellect, if not with his heart, for he stared at the man and made no answer. In the language of the ring he was quite knocked out, and almost humbly changed the subject.
"We have yet a little while," he said, "before that happens which I have decreed. Come, Humphrey, that I may show you some of the marvels of this bubble blown in the bowels of the world."
And he motioned us to pick up the lanterns. Then he led us away from the wall of the cavern, if such it was, for a distance of perhaps 600 or 700 paces. Here suddenly we came to a great groove in the rocky floor, as broad as a very wide roadway, and mayhap 4 feet in depth. The bottom of this groove was polished, and glittered. Indeed, it gave the impression of being iron, or other ore, which had been welded together beneath the grinding of some immeasurable weight. Just at the spot where we struck the groove, it divided into two, for this reason. In its center, the floor of iron, or whatever it may have been, rose, the fraction of an inch at first, but afterwards more sharply, and this at a spot where the groove had a somewhat steep downward dip, which appeared to extend onwards I know not how far. Following along this central rise for a great way, nearly a mile, I should think, we observed that it became ever more pronounced, till at length it ended in a razor-edged cliff, which stretched up higher than we could see, even by the light of the electrical discharges. Standing against the edge of this cliff, we perceived that at a distance from it there were now two grooves of about equal width. One of these ran away into the darkness on our right as we faced the sharp edge, and at an ever-widening angle, while the other, at a similar angle, ran into the darkness to the left of the knife of cliff. That was all. No, there were two more notable things. Neither of the grooves now lay within hundreds of yards of the cliff, perhaps a quarter of a mile, for be it remembered we had followed the rising rock between them. To put it quite clearly, it was exactly as though one line of rails had separated into two lines of rails, as often enough they do, and an observer standing on high ground between them could see them both vanishing into tunnels to the right and left, but far apart. The second notable thing was that the right-hand groove, where first we saw it at the point of separation, was not polished like the left-hand groove, although at some time or other it seemed to have been subjected to the pressure of the same terrific weight, which cut its fellow out of the bed of rock or iron, as the sharp wheels of a heavily laden wagon sink ruts into a roadway. "What does it all mean, Lord Oro?" I asked, when he had led us back to the spot where the one groove began to be two grooves, that is, a mile or so away from that razor-edged cliff.
"This, Humphrey," he answered. "That which travels along yonder road, when it reaches this spot on which we stand, follows the left-hand path, which is made bright with this passage. Yet, could a giant at that moment of its touching this exact spot on which I lay my hand, thrust it with sufficient strength, it would leave the left-hand road and take the right-hand road."
"And what if it did, Lord Oro?"
"Then, within an hour or so, when it had traveled far enough upon its way, the balance of the earth would be changed, and great things would happen in the world above, as once they happened in bygone days. Now do you understand, Humphrey?"
"Good heavens! Yes, I understand now," I answered. "But fortunately there is no such giant." Oro broke into a mocking laugh, and his gray old face lit up with a fiendish exultation as he cried,
"Fool! I, Oro, am that giant! Once in the dead days I turned the balance of the world from the right-hand road, which now is dull with disuse, to the left-hand road which glitters so brightly to your eyes, and the face of the earth was changed. Now again I will turn it from the left-hand road to the right-hand road, in which for millions of years it was wont to run, and once more the face of the earth shall change, and those who are left living upon the earth, or who, in the course of ages, shall come to live upon the new earth, must bow down to Oro, and take him and his seed to be their gods and kings."
When I heard this, I was overwhelmed, and could not answer. Also I remembered a certain confused picture which Eva had shown to us in the Temple of Nyo. But, supported by his disbelief, Bickley asked, "And how often does the balance of which you speak come this way, Lord Oro?" Only once in many years. The number is my secret, Bickley, he replied. And then there is every reason to hope that it will not trouble us, remarked Bickley, with a suspicion of mockery in his voice.
Do you think so, you learned Bickley? Asked Oro. If so, I do not. Unless my skill has failed me and my calculations have gone awry, that traveler of which I tell should presently be with us. Hearken now, what is that sound we hear?
As he spoke, there reached our ears the first far-off murmurs of a dreadful music. I cannot describe it in words, because that is impossible, but it was something like to the buzz of a thousand humming tops, such as are loved by children because of their weird song.
Back to the wall, cried Oro triumphantly. The time is short.
So back we went, Oro pausing a while behind and overtaking us with long determined strides. Iva led us, gliding at my side and, as I thought now and again, glanced at my face with a look that was half anxious and half pitiful. Also twice she stopped and patted Tommy. We reached the wall, though not quite at the spot whence we had started to examine the grooved roads. At least, I think this is so, since now, for the first time, I observed a kind of little window in its rocky face. It stood about 5 feet from the floor level, and was perhaps 10 inches square, not more. In short, except for its shape, it resembled a ship's porthole rather than a window. Its substance appeared to be talc, or some such material, and inches thick. Yet through it, after Oro had cast aside some sort of covering, came a glare like that of a searchlight. In fact, it was a searchlight, so far as concerned one of its purposes. By this window or porthole lay a pile of cloaks. Also, four objects which looked like Zulu battle shields, cut in some unknown metal or material. Very deftly, very quietly, Iva lifted these cloaks and wrapped one of them about each of us, and while she was thus employed I noticed that they were of a substance very similar to that of the gown she wore, which I have described, but harder. Next, she gave one of the metal-like shields to each of us, bidding us hold them in front of our bodies and heads, and only to look through certain slits in them, which were eye-pieces that appeared to be of the same horny stuff as the searchlight window. Further, she commanded us to stand in a row with our backs against the rock wall, at certain spots which she indicated with great precision, and whatever we saw or heard on no account to move. So there we stood, Bickley next to me, and beyond him Baston. Then Iva took the fourth shield, as I noted a much larger one than ours, and placed herself between me and the searchlight or porthole. On the other side of this was Oro, who had no shield. These arrangements took some minutes, and during that time occupied all our attention. When they were completed, however, our curiosity and fear began to reassert themselves. I looked about me and perceived that Oro had his right hand upon what seemed to be a rough stone rod, in shape not unlike that with which railway points are moved. He shouted to us to stand still and keep the shields over our faces. Then, very gently, he pressed upon the lever. The porthole sank the fraction of an inch, and instantly there leapt from it a most terrific blaze of lightning, which shot across the blackness in front and, as lightning does, revealed far, far away another wall or rather cliff like that against which we leant.
All works well, exclaimed Oro in a satisfied voice, lifting his hand from the rod, and the strength which I have stored will be more than enough.
Meanwhile, the humming noise came nearer and grew in volume.
I say, said Bickley, as you know I have been skeptical, but I don't like this business. Oro, what are you going to do?
Sink half the world beneath the seas, said Oro, and raise up that which I drowned more than 2,000 centuries ago. But as you do not believe that I have this power, Bickley, why do you ask such questions?
I believe that you have it, which is why I tried to shoot you yesterday, said Baston. For your soul's sake, I beg you to desist from an attempt which I am sure will not succeed, but will certainly involve your eternal damnation, since the failure will be no fault of yours.
Then I spoke also, saying, I implore you, Lord Oro, to let this business be. I do not know exactly how much or how little you can do, but I understand that your object is to slay men by millions, in order to raise up another world of which you will be the absolute king, as you were of some past empire that has been destroyed, either through your agency or otherwise. No good can come of such ambitions. Like Baston, for your soul's sake I pray you to let them be.
What Humphrey says I repeat, said Iva. My father, although you know it not, you seek great evil, and from these hopes you sow, you will harvest nothing save a loss of which you do not dream. Moreover, your plans will fail. Now I, who am like yourself of the children of wisdom, have spoken for the first and last time, and my words are true. I pray you, give them weight, my father.
Oro heard, and grew furious.
What? He said. Are you against me, every one, and my own daughter also? I would lift you up. I would make you rulers of a new world. I would destroy your vile civilizations, which I have studied with my eyes, that I may build better. To you, Humphrey, I would give my only child in marriage, that from you may spring a divine race of kings.
and yet you are against me, and set up your puny scruples as a barrier across my path of wisdom. Well, I tread them down, I go on my appointed way, but beware how you try to hold me back. If any one of you should attempt to come between me and my ends, know that I will destroy you all. Obey or die.
Well, he has had his chance and he won't take it, said Baston in the silence that followed. The man must go to the devil in his own way, and there is nothing more to be said.
I say the silence, but it was no more silent. The distant humming drew to a roar, the roar to a hellish hurricane of sound which presently drowned all attempts at ordinary speech. Then, bellowing like 10 millions of bulls, at length, far away, there appeared something terrible. I can only describe its appearance as that of an attenuated mountain on fire. When it drew nearer, I perceived that it was more like a ballet dancer, whirling round and round upon her toes, or rather, all the ballet dancers in the world rolled up into one and then multiplied a million times in size. No, it was like a mushroom, with two stalks, one above and one below, or a huge top, with a point on which it spun, a swelling belly, and another point above. But what a top! It must have been 2,000 feet high if it was an inch, and its circumference who could measure? On it came, dancing, swaying, and spinning at a rate inconceivable, so that it looked like a gigantic wheel of fire. Yet it was not fire that clothed it, but rather some phosphorescence, since from it came no heat. Yes, a phosphorescence arranged in bands of ghastly blue and lurid red, with streaks of other colors running up between, and a kind of wavering fringe of purple. The Fire Mountain thundered on with a voice like to that of avalanches or of icebergs crashing from their apparent glaciers to the sea. Its terrific aspect was appalling, and its weight caused the solid rock to quiver like a leaf. Watching it, we felt as ants might feel at the advent of the crack of doom, for its mere height and girth and size overwhelmed us. We could not even speak. The last words I heard were from the mouth of Oro, who screamed out,
"Behold the balance of the world, you miserable doubting men, and behold me change its path, turning it as the steersman turns a ship."
Then he made certain signs to Iva, who, in obedience to them, approached the porthole or searchlight, to which she did something that I could not distinguish. The effect was to make the beam of light much stronger and sharper, also to shift it onto the point or foot of the spinning mountain, and, by an aiming of the lens from time to time, to keep it there. This went on for a while, since the dreadful thing did not travel fast, notwithstanding the frightful speed of its revolutions. I should doubt indeed if it advanced more quickly than a man could walk, at any rate, so it seemed to us, but we had no means of judging its real rate of progress, whereof we knew as little as we did of the course it followed in the bowels of the earth. Perhaps that was spiral, from the world's deep heart upwards, and this was the highest point it reached. Or perhaps it remained stationary, but still spinning for scores or hundreds of years, in some central powerhouse of its own, whence, in obedience to unknown laws, from time to time it made these terrific journeys. No one knows, unless perhaps Oro did, in which case he kept the information to himself, and no one will ever know. At any rate, there it was, traveling toward us on its giant butt, the peg of the top, as it were, which, hidden in a cloud of friction-borne sparks that enveloped it like the cup of a curving flower of fire, whirled round and round at an infinite speed. It was on this flaming flower that the searchlight played steadily, doubtless that Oro might mark and measure its monstrous progress.
"He is going to try to send the thing down the right-hand path," I shouted into Bickley's ear. "Can't be done. Nothing can shift a traveling weight of tens of millions of tons 1 inch," Bickley roared back, trying to look confident. Clearly, however, Iva thought that it could be done, for of a sudden she cast down her shield, and, throwing herself upon her knees, stretched out her hands in supplication to her father. I understood, as did we all, that she was imploring him to abandon his hellish purpose. He glared at her, and shook his head. Then, as she still went on praying, he struck her across the face with his hand, and pushed her to her feet again. My blood boiled as I saw it, and I think I should have sprung at him, had not Bickley caught hold of me, shouting, "Don't, or he will kill her and us too!" Iva lifted her shield and returned to her station, and in the blue discharges which now flashed almost continuously, and the phosphorescent glare of the advancing mountain, I saw that though her beautiful face worked beneath the pain of the blow, her eyes remained serene and purposeful. Even then I wondered, what was the purpose shining through them? Also, I wondered if I was about to be called upon to make that sacrifice of which she had spoken. And if so, how? Of one thing I was determined, that if the call came it should not find me deaf. Yet all the while I was horribly afraid. At another sign from Oro, Iva did something more to the lens. Again, being alongside of her, I could not see what it was. The beam of light shifted, and wandered till, far away, it fell exactly upon that spot where the rock began to rise into the ridge, which separated the two grooves or roads, and ended in the razor-edge cliff. Moreover, I observed that Oro, who left it the last of us, had either placed something white to mark this first infinitesimal bulging of the floor of the groove, or had smeared it with chalk or shining pigment. I observed also what I had not been able to see before, that a thin white line ran across the floor, no doubt to give the precise direction of this painted rise of rock, and that the glare of the searchlight now lay exactly over that line. The monstrous, flaming gyroscope fashioned in nature's workshop, for such without doubt it was drawing near, emitting as it came a tumult of sounds which, with the echoes that they caused, almost overwhelmed our senses. Poor little Tommy, already cowed, although he was a bold-natured beast, broke down entirely, and I could see from his open mouth that he was howling with terror. He stared about him, then ran to Eva and pawed at her, evidently asking to be taken into her arms. She thrust him away almost fiercely, and made signs to me to lift him up and hold him beneath my shield. This I did, reflecting sadly that if I was to be sacrificed, Tommy must share my fate. I even thought of passing him on to Bickley, but had no time. Indeed, I could not attract his attention, for Bickley was staring with all his eyes at the nightmare-like spectacle which was in progress about us. Indeed, no nightmare, no wild imagination of which the mind of man is capable, could rival the aspect of its stupendous facts. Think of them! The unmeasured space of blackness, threaded by those globes of ghastly incandescence that now hung a while, and now shot upwards, downwards, across, apparently without origin or end, like a stream of meteors that had gone mad. Then, the traveling mountain, 2,000 feet in height or more, with its enormous saucer-like rim painted round with bands of lurid red and blue, at about its grinding foot the tulip bloom of emitted flame. Then the fierce-faced Oro at his post, his hand upon the rod, waiting remorseless to drown half of this great world, with the lovely Eva standing calm-eyed like a saint in hell, and watching me above the edge of the shield, which such a saint might bear to turn aside the fiery darts of the wicked. And lastly we three men, flattened, terror-stricken against the wall. Nightmare! Imagination! No, these pale before that scene which was given to our human eyes to witness. And all the while, bending, bowing towards us, away from us, making obeisance to the path in front as though in greeting, to the path behind as though in farewell, instinct with a horrible life, with a hideous and gigantic grace, that titanic terror whirled onwards to the mark of fate. At that moment nothing could persuade me that it was not alive and did not know its awful mission. Visions flashed across my mind. I thought of the peoples of the world sleeping in their beds, or going about their business, or engaged even in the work of war. I thought of the ships upon the seas steaming steadily towards their far-off ports. Then I thought of what presently might happen to them, of the tremors followed by convulsions, of the sudden crashing down of cities, such as we had seen in the picture Eva showed us in the temple, of the inflow of the waters of the deep piled up in mighty waves, of the woe and desolation as of the end of the world, and of the quiet following death. So I thought, and in my heart prayed to the great architect of the universe to stretch out his arm to avert this fearsome ruin of his handiwork. Oro glared. His thin fingers tightened their grip upon the rod. His hair and long beard seemed to bristle with furious and delighted excitement. The purple-fringed rim of the monster had long overshadowed the whited patch of rock. Its grinding foot was scarce 10 yards away. Oro made more signs to Eva, who, beneath the shelter of her shield, again bent down and did something that I could not see. Then, as though her part were played, she rose, drew the gray hood of her cloak all about her face so that her eyes alone remained visible, took one step towards me, and in the broken English we had taught her, called into my ear.
Humphrey, God you bless. Humphrey, we meet soon. Forget not me.
She stepped back again before I could attempt to answer, and next instant with a hideous concentrated effort, Oro, bending himself double, thrust upon the rod as I could see from his open mouth, shouting while he thrust. At the same moment, with a swift spring, Eva leapt immediately in front of the lens or window, so that the metallic shield with which she covered herself pressed against its substance. Simultaneously, Oro flung up his arms as though in horror. Too late! The shutter fell, and from behind it there sprang out a rush of living flame. It struck on Eva's shield, and expanded to right and left. The insulated shield and garments that she wore seemed to resist it. For a fraction of time she stood there like a glowing angel wrapped in fire. Then she was swept outwards and upwards, and at a little distance dissolved like a ghost and vanished from our sight. Eva was ashes. Eva was gone. The sacrifice was consummated. And not in vain. Not in vain. On her poor breast she had received the full blast of that hellish lightning flash, yet, whilst destroying, it turned away from her, seeking the free paths of the air. So it came about that its obstructed strength struck the foot of the traveling gyroscope, diffused, and did not suffice to thrust it, that one necessary inch on which depended the fate of half the world, or, missing it altogether, passed away on either side. Even so, the huge gleaming mountain rocked and trembled. Once, twice, thrice it bowed itself towards us, as though in majestic homage to greatness passed away. For a second, too, its course was checked, and at the check the earth quaked and trembled. Yes, then the world shook, and the blue globes of fire went out, while I was thrown to the ground.
When they returned again, the flaming monster was once more sailing majestically upon its way and down the accustomed left-hand path. Indeed, the sacrifice was not in vain. The world shook, but Iva had saved the world.
Chapter 26. Tommy.
I lay still a while, on my back as I had fallen, and beneath the shield-like defense which Iva had given to me. Notwithstanding the fire-resisting metallized stuff of which it was made, I noted that it was twisted and almost burned through. Doubtless, the stored-up electricity or earth magnetism or whatever it may be that had leapt out of that hole, being diffused by the resistance with which it was met, had grazed me with its outer edge, and had it not been for the shield and cloak, I also should have been burned up. I wished, oh, how I wished that it had been so. Then, by now, all must have finished, and I should have known the truth as to what awaits us beyond the change, sleep or dreams, or perchance the fullest life. Also, I should not have learned alone. Lying there thus, idly as though in a half-sleep, I felt Tommy licking my face, and throwing my arm about the poor little frightened beast, I watched the great world balance as it retreated on its eternal journey. At one time, its vast projecting rim had overshadowed us, and almost seemed to touch the cliff of rock against which we leant. I remember that the effect of that shining arch 1,000 feet or so above our heads was wonderful. It reminded me of a canopy of blackest thunder clouds supported upon a framework of wheeling rainbows, while beneath it all the children of the devil shouted together in joy. I noted this effect only a few seconds before Iva spoke to me, and leapt into the path of the flash. Now, however, it was far away, a mere flaming wheel that became gradually smaller, and its satanic voices were growing faint. As I have said, I watched its disappearance idly, reflecting that I should never look upon its like again, also that it was something well worth going forth to see. Then I became aware that the humming, howling din had decreased sufficiently to enable me to hear human voices without effort. Baston was addressing Bickley. Like myself, they were both upon the ground.
Her translation, as you may have noticed, Bickley, if you were not too frightened, was really very remarkable. No doubt it will have reminded you, as it did me, of that of Elijah. She had exactly the appearance of a person going up to heaven in a vehicle of fire. The destination was certainly the same, and even the cloak she wore added a familiar touch and increased the similarity.
At any rate, it did not fall upon you,
answered Bickley, with something like a sob, in a voice of mingled awe and exasperation.
For goodness sake, Baston, stop your biblical parallels, and let us adore, yes, let us adore the divinest creature that the earth has borne.
Never have I loved Bickley more than when I heard him utter those words.
Divinest is a large term, Bickley, and one to which I hesitate to subscribe, remembering as I do certain of the prophets and the early fathers with all their faults, not, of course, to mention the apostles, but...
Here he paused, for suddenly all three of us became aware of Oro. He also had been thrown to the ground by the strength of the prisoned forces which he gathered and loosed upon their unholy errand, but, as I rejoice to observe, had suffered from them much more than ourselves. Doubtless this was owing to the fact that he had sprung forward in a last wild effort to save his daughter, or to prevent her from interfering with his experiment, I know not which. As a result, his right cheek was much scorched, his right arm was withered and helpless, and his magnificent beard was half burnt off him. Further, very evidently he was suffering from severe shock, for he rocked upon his feet and shook like an aspen leaf. All this, however, did not interfere with the liveliness of his grief and rage. There he stood, a towering shape like a lightning-smitten statue, and cursed us, especially Baston.
"My daughter is gone," he cried, "burned up by the fiery power that is my servant. Nothing remains of her but dust, and priest, this is your doing. You poisoned her heart with your childish doctrines of mercy and sacrifice, and the rest, so that she threw herself into the path of the Flash to save some miserable races that she had never even known."
He paused, exhausted, whereon Baston answered him with spirit,
"Yes, Oro, she being a holy woman, has gone whither you will never follow her. Also, it is your own fault, since you should have listened to her entreaties instead of boxing her ears like the brute you are."
"My daughter is gone," went on Oro, recovering his strength, "and my great designs are ruined. Yet only for a while," he added, "for the world balance will return again, if not till long after your life spans are done."
"If you don't doctor yourself, Lord Oro," said Bickley, also rising, "I may tell you, as one who understands such things, that most likely it will be after your lifespan is done also. Although their effects may be delayed, severe shocks from burns and overexcitement are apt to prove fatal to the aged."
Oro snarled at him. No other word describes it. "And there are other things, physician," he said, "which are apt to prove fatal to the young. At least now you will no longer deny my power."
"I am not so sure," answered Bickley, "since it seems that there is a greater power, namely that of a woman's love and sacrifice."
"And a greater still," interrupted Baston, "which put those ideas into her head."
"As for you, Humphrey," went on Oro, "I rejoice to think that you at least have lost two things that man desires above all other things, the woman you sought and the future kingship of the world."
I stood up and faced him. "The first I have gained, although how you do not understand, Oro," I answered. "And of the second, seeing that it would have come through you, on your conditions, I am indeed glad to be rid. I wish no power that springs from murder, and no gifts from one who answered his daughter's prayer with blows."
For a moment, he seemed remorseful.
"She vexed me with her foolishness," he said.
Then his rage blazed up again.
"And it was you who taught it to her," he went on. "You are guilty, all three of you, and therefore I am left with none to serve me in my age. Therefore also my mighty schemes are overthrown."
"Also, Oro, if you speak truth, therefore half the world is saved," I added quietly, "and one has left it of whom it was unworthy."
"You think that these civilizations of yours, as you are pleased to call them, are saved, do you?"
he sneered.
"Yet even if Bickley were right, and I should die and become powerless, I tell you that they are already damned. I have studied them in your books, and seen them with my eyes, and I say that they are rotten before ever they are ripe, and that their end shall be the end of the sons of wisdom, to die for lack of increase. That is why I would have saved the East, because in it alone there is increase, and thence alone can rise the great last race of men, which I would have given to your children for an heritage. Moreover, think not that you Westerners have done with wars. I tell you that they are but begun, and that the sword shall eat you up, and what the sword spares, class shall snatch from class in the struggle for supremacy and ease."
Thus he spoke with extraordinary and concentrated bitterness that I confess would have frightened me had I been capable of fear, which, at the moment, I was not. Who is afraid when he has lost all? Nor was Baston alarmed, if for other reasons.
"I think it right to tell you, Oro," he said, "that the only future you need trouble about is your own. God Almighty will look after the Western civilizations in whatever way he may think best, as you may remember he did just now, only I am sure you won't be here to see how it is done."
Again, fury blazed in Oro's eyes.
"At least I will look after you, you half-bred dogs, who yap out ill-omened prophecies of death into my face. Since the three of you loved my daughter whom you brought to her doom, and were by her beloved, if differently, I think it best that you should follow on her road. How? That is the question. Shall I leave you to starve in these great caves? Nay, look not toward the road of escape which doubtless she pointed out to you, for as Humphrey knows, I can travel swiftly, and I will make sure that you find it blocked. Or shall I..."
And he glanced upwards at the great globes of wandering fire, as though he purposed to summon them to be our death, as doubtless he could have done.
"I do not care what you do," I answered wearily. "Only I would beg you to strike quickly. Yet for my friends I am sorry, since it was I who led them on this quest. And for you too, Tommy," I added, looking at the poor little hound. "You were foolish, Tommy," I went on, "when you scented out that old tyrant in his coffin, at least for your own sake."
Indeed, the dog was terribly scared. He whined continually, and from time to time ran a little way, and then returned to us, suggesting that we should go from this horror-haunted spot. Lastly, as though he understood that it was Oro who kept us there, he went to him, and jumping up, licked his hand in a beseeching fashion. The Superman looked at the dog, and as he looked, the rage went out of his face, and was replaced by something resembling pity.
"I do not wish the beast to die," he muttered to himself, in low reflective tones, as though he thought aloud. "Four of them all it alone liked and did not fear me. I might take it with me, but still it would perish of grief in the loneliness of the caves. Moreover, she loved it, whom I shall see no more. Yes, Iva."
As he spoke the name, his voice broke a little.
"Yet, if I suffer them to escape, they will tell my story to the world, and make me a laughingstock. Well, if they do, what does it matter? None of these Western fools would believe it, thinking that they know all. Like Bickley, they would mock and say that they were mad or liars."
Again Tommy licked his hand, but more confidently, as though instinct told him something of what was passing in Oro's mind. I watched with an idle wonder, marveling whether it were possible that this merciless being would, after all, spare us for the sake of the dog. So, strange to say, it came about, for suddenly Oro looked up and said,
"Get you gone, and quickly before my mood changes. The hound has saved you. For its sake I give you your lives, who otherwise should certainly have died. She who is gone pointed out to you, I doubt not, a road that runs to the upper air. I think that it is still open. Indeed," he added, closing his eyes for a moment, "I see that it is still open, if long and difficult, Follow it, and should you win through, take your boat and sail away as swiftly as you can. Whether you die or live, I care nothing. But my hands will be clean of your blood, although yours are stained with Iva's. Begone, and my curse go with you.
Without waiting for further words, we went to fetch our lanterns, water bottles, and bag of food, which we had laid down at a little distance. As we approached them, I looked up and saw Oro standing some way off. The light from one of the blue globes of fire which passed close above his head shone upon him and made him ghastly. Moreover, it seemed to me as though approaching death had written its name upon his malevolent countenance. I turned my head away, for about his aspect in those sinister surroundings there was something horrible, something menacing and repellent to man, and of him I wished to see no more. Nor indeed did I, for when I glanced in that direction again, Oro was gone. I suppose that he had retreated into the shadows, where no light played. We gathered up our gear, and while the others were relighting the lanterns, I walked a few paces forward to the spot where Iva had been dissolved in the devouring fire. Something caught my eye upon the rocky floor. I picked it up. It was the ring, or rather, the remains of the ring, that I had given her on that night when we declared our love amidst the ruins by the Critter Lake. She had never worn it on her hand, but for her own reasons, as she told me, suspended it upon her breast beneath her robe. It was an ancient ring that I had bought in Egypt, fashioned of gold in which was set a very hard basalt or other black stone. On this was engraved the Ankh or looped cross, which was the Egyptian symbol of life, and round it a snake, the symbol of eternity. The gold was for the most part melted, but the stone, being so hard and protected by the shield and asbestos cloak, for such I suppose it was, had resisted the fury of the flash, only now it was white instead of black, like a burnt onyx that had known the funeral pyre. Indeed, perhaps it was an onyx. I kissed it, and hid it away, for it seemed to me to convey a greeting, and with it a promise. Then we started, a very sad and dejected trio. Leaving with a shudder that vast place where the blue lights played eternally, we came to the shaft, up and down which the traveling stone pursued its endless path, and saw it arrive and depart again. "I wonder that he did not send us that way," said Bickley, pointing to it.
"I am sure I am very glad it never occurred to him," answered Baston, "for I am certain that we could not have made the journey again without our guide, Iva."
I looked at him, and he ceased. Somehow I could not bear as yet to hear her beloved name spoken by other lips. Then we entered the passage that she pointed out to us, and began a most terrible journey, which, so far as we could judge, for we lost any exact count of time, took us about 60 hours. The road, it is true, was smooth and unblocked, but the ascent was fearfully steep and slippery, so much so that often we were obliged to pull each other up it and lie down to rest. Had it not been for those large felt-covered bottles of life water, I am sure we should never have won through. But this marvelous elixir, drunk a little at a time, always reinvigorated us and gave us strength to push on. Also, we had some food, and fortunately our spare oil held out, for the darkness in that tunnel was complete. Tommy became so exhausted that at length we must carry him by turns. He would have died had it not been for the water. Indeed, I thought that he was going to die. After our last rest and a short sleep, however, he seemed to begin to recover, and generally there was something in his manner which suggested to us that he knew himself to be not far from the surface of the earth, towards which we had crawled upwards for thousands upon thousands of feet, fortunately, without meeting with any zone of heat which was not bearable. We were right, for when we had staggered forward a little further, suddenly Tommy ran ahead of us and vanished. Then we heard him barking, but where we could not see, since the tunnel appeared to take a turn and continue, but this time on a downward course, while the sound of the barks came from our right. We searched with the lanterns, which were now beginning to die, and found a little hole almost filled with fallen pieces of rock. We scooped these away with our hands, making an aperture large enough to creep through. A few more yards, and we saw light, the blessed light of the moon, and in it stood Tommy, barking hoarsely. Next we heard the sound of the sea. We struggled on desperately, and presently pushed our way through bushes and vegetation on to a steep declivity. Down this we rolled and scrambled, to find ourselves at last lying upon a sandy beach, whilst above us the full moon shone in the heavens. Here, with a prayer of thankfulness, we flung ourselves down and slept. If it had not been for Tommy, and we had gone further along the tunnel, which I have little doubt stretched on beneath the sea, where, I wonder, should we have slept that night? When we woke, the sun was shining high in the heavens. Evidently there had been rain towards the dawn, though as we were lying beneath the shelter of some broad-leaved tree, from it we had suffered little inconvenience. Oh, how beautiful after our sojourn in those unholy caves, were the sun and the sea, and the sweet air, and the raindrops hanging on the leaves! We did not wake of ourselves. Indeed, if we had been left alone, I am sure that we should have slept the clock round, for we were terribly exhausted. What woke us was the chatter of a crowd of Orofenans, who were gathered at a distance from the tree and engaged in staring at us in a frightened way, also the barks of Tommy, who objected to their intrusion. Among the people I recognized our old friend, the Chief Marama, by his feather cloak, and, sitting up, beckoned him to approach. After a good deal of hesitation he came, walking delicately like Agag, and stopping from time to time to study us as though he were not sure that we were real.
"What frightens you, Marama?" I asked him.
"You frighten us, O friend from the sea. Whence did you and the healer and the bellower come, and why do your faces look like those of ghosts, and why is the little black beast so large-eyed and so thin? Over the lake we know you did not come, for we have watched day and night. Moreover, there is no canoe upon the shore, also it would not have been possible."
"Why not?" I asked idly.
"Come and see," he answered.
Rising stiffly, we emerged from beneath the tree, and perceived that we were at the foot of the cliff against which the remains of the yacht had been borne by the great tempest. Indeed, there it was, within a couple of hundred yards of us. Following Marama, we climbed the sloping path which ran up the cliff, and ascended a knoll whence we could see the lake and the cone of the volcano in its center. At least, we used to be able to see this cone, but now, at any rate with a naked eye, we could make out nothing except a small brown spot in the midst of the waters of the lake.
"The mountain, which rose up many feet in that storm which brought you to Orofena, friend from the sea, has now sunk till only the very top of it is to be seen," said Marama solemnly. "Even the rock of offerings has vanished beneath the water, and with it the house that we built for you."
"Yes," I said, affecting no surprise. "But when did that happen?"
5 nights ago the world shook, friend from the sea, and when the sun rose we saw that the mouth of the cave which appeared on the day of your coming had vanished, and that the holy mountain itself had sunk deep, so that now only the crust of it is left above the water."
"Such things happen," I replied carelessly.
"Yes, friend from the sea, like many other marvels, they happen where you and your companions are. Therefore we beg you, who can arise out of the earth like spirits, to leave us at once before our island and all of us who dwell thereon are drowned beneath the ocean. Leave us before we kill you, if indeed you be men, or die at your hands, if, as we think, you be evil spirits who can throw up mountains and drag them down, and create gods that slay and move about in the bowels of the world."
"That is our intention, for our business here is done," I answered calmly.
"Come now, and help us to depart. But first bring us food. Bring it in plenty, for we must victual our boat."
Marama bowed, and issued the necessary orders. Indeed, food sufficient for our immediate needs was already there as an offering, and of it we ate with thankfulness. Then we boarded the ship and examined the lifeboat. Thanks to our precautions, it was still in very fair order, and only needed some little caulking, which we did with grass fiber and pitch from the stores. After this, with the help of the Orofenans, who worked hard in their desperate desire to be rid of us, we drew the boat into the sea, and provisioned her with stores from the ship, and with an ample supply of water. Everything being ready at last, we waited for the evening wind, which always blew offshore, to start. As it was not due for half an hour or more, I walked back to the tree under which we had slept and tried to find the hole whence we had emerged from the tunnel onto the face of the cliff. My hurried search proved useless. The declivity of the cliff was covered with tropical growth, and the heavy rain had washed away every trace of our descent, and very likely filled the hole itself with earth. At any rate, of it I could discover nothing. Then, as the breeze began to blow, I returned to the boat, and here bade adieu to Marama, who gave me his feather cloak as a farewell gift.
"Goodbye, friend from the sea," he said to me. "We are glad to have seen you, and thank you for many things, but we do not wish to see you any more."
"Goodbye, Marama," I answered. "What do you say? We echo. At least, now you have no great lump upon your neck, and we have rid you of your wizards. But beware of the god Oro who dwells in the mountain, for if you anger him he will sink your island beneath the sea."
"And remember all that I have taught you," shouted Baston.
Marama shivered, though whether at the mention of the god Oro, of whose powers the Orofenans had so painful a recollection, or at the result of Baston's teachings, I do not know. And that was the last we shall ever see of each other in this world. The island faded behind us, and, sore at heart because of all that we had found and lost again, for 3 days we sailed northward with a fair and steady wind. On the fourth evening, by an extraordinary stroke of fortune, we fell in with an American tramp steamer trading from the South Sea Islands to San Francisco. To the captain, who treated us very kindly, we said simply that we were a party of Englishmen whose yacht had been wrecked on a small island several hundreds of miles away, of which we knew neither the name, if it had one, nor the position. This story was accepted without question, for such things often happen in these latitudes, and in due course we were landed at San Francisco, where we made certain depositions before the British consul as to the loss of the yacht Star of the South. Then we crossed America, having obtained funds by cable, and sailed for England in a steamer bearing the flag of the United States. Of the great war which made this desirable I do not speak, since it has nothing, or rather little, to do with this history. In the end we arrived safely at Liverpool, and thence travelled to our homes in Devonshire. Thus ended the history of our dealings with Oro, the Superman who began his life more than 250,000 years ago, and with his daughter Iva, whom Baston still often calls the Glittering Lady.
Chapter 27. Bastin discovers a resemblance. There is little more to tell. Shortly after our return, Bickley, like a patriotic Englishman, volunteered for service at the front and departed in the uniform of the RAMC. Before he left, he took the opportunity of explaining to Bastin how much better it was in such a national emergency as existed to belong to a profession in which a man could do something to help the bodies of his countrymen that had been broken in the common cause than to one like his in which it was only possible to pelt them with vain words.
"You think that, do you, Bickley?" answered Bastin. "Well, I hold that it is better to heal souls than bodies, because, as even you will have learned out there in Orofena, they last so much longer."
"I am not certain that I learned anything of the sort," said Bickley. "Or even that Oro was more than an ordinary old man. He said that he had lived 1,000 years. But what was there to prove this except his word, which was worth nothing?"
"There was the Lady Iva's word also, which is worth a great deal, Bickley."
"Yes. But she may have meant 1,000 moons. Further, as according to her own showing she was still quite young, how could she know her father's age?"
"Quite so, Bickley. But all she actually said was that she was of the same age as one of our women of 27, which may have meant 270 for all that I know. However, putting that aside, you will admit that they had both slept for 250,000 years.
"I admit that they slept, Bastin, because I helped to awaken them. But for how long there is nothing to show, except those star maps which are probably quite inaccurate."
"They are not inaccurate," I broke in, "for I have had them checked by leading astronomers who say that they show a marvelous knowledge of the heavens as these were 250,000 years ago and are today. Here I should state that those two metal maps and the ring which I gave to Iva and found again after the catastrophe were absolutely the only things connected with her or Oro that we brought away with us. The former I would never part with, feeling their value as evidence. Therefore, when we descended to the city Nyo in the depths beneath, I took them with me wrapped in cloth in my pocket. Thus they were preserved. Everything else went when the Rock of Offerings in the cave mouth sank beneath the waters of the lake. This may have happened either in the earth tremor, which no doubt was caused by the advance of the terrific world balance, or when the electric power, though diffused and turned by Iva's insulated body, struck that great gyroscope's traveling foot with sufficient strength, not to shift it indeed onto the right-hand path as Oro had designed, but still to cause it to stagger, and even perhaps to halt for the fraction of a second. Even this pause may have been enough to cause convulsions of the earth above. Indeed, I gathered from Marama and other Orofenans that such convulsions had occurred on and around the island at what must have corresponded with that moment of the loosing of the force. The loss of our belongings in the House of the Rock of Offerings was the more grievous, because among them were some Kodak photographs which I had taken, including portraits of Oro and one of Iva that was really excellent, to say nothing of pictures of the mouth of the cave and of the ruins and crater lake above. How bitterly I regret that I did not keep these photographs in my pocket with the map plates.
"Even if the star maps are correct, still it proves nothing," said Bickley, "since possibly Oro's astronomical skill might have enabled him to draw that of the sky at any period, although I allow this is impossible."
"I doubt his taking so much trouble merely to deceive three wanderers who lack the knowledge even to check them," I said. "But all this misses the point, Bickley. However long they had slept, that man and woman did arise from a seeming death. They did dwell in those marvelous caves with their evidences of departed civilizations, and they did show us the fearful world-wandering gyroscope. These things we saw."
"I admit that we saw them, Arbuthnot, and I admit that they are one and all beyond human comprehension. To that extent, I am converted, and I may add, humbled," said Bickley.
"So you ought to be," exclaimed Bastin, "seeing that you were always swore that there was nothing in the world that is not capable of a perfectly natural explanation."
"Of which all these things may be capable, Bastin, if only we held the key."
"Very well, Bickley, but how do you explain what the Lady Iva did? I may tell you now what she commanded me to conceal at the time, namely, that she became a Christian, so much so that by her own will I baptized and confirmed her on the very morning of her sacrifice. Doubtless it was this that changed her heart so much that she became willing, of course, without my knowledge, to leave everything she cared for."
Here he looked at me.
"And lay down her life to save the world, half of which she believed was about to be drowned by Oro. Now, considering her history and upbringing, I call this a spiritual marvel, much greater than any you now admit, and one you can't explain, Bickley."
"No, I cannot explain, or at any rate I will not try," he answered, also staring hard at me. "Whatever she believed or did not believe, and whatever would or would not have happened, she was a great and wonderful woman whose memory I worship."
"Quite so, Bickley, and now perhaps you see my point, that what you describe as mere vain words may also be helpful to mankind, more so indeed than your surgical instruments and pills."
"You couldn't convert Oro anyway," exclaimed Bickley with irritation.
"No, Bickley, but then I have always understood that the devil is beyond conversion because he is beyond repentance.
You see, I think that if that old scoundrel was not the devil himself, at any rate he was a bit of him, and if I am right, I am not ashamed to have failed in his case.
Even Oro was not utterly bad, Baston, I said, reflecting on certain traits of mercy that he had shown, or that I dreamed him to have shown, in the course of our mysterious midnight journeys to various parts of the earth. Also, I remember that he had loved Tommy, and for his sake had spared our lives. Lastly, I do not altogether wonder that he came to certain hasty conclusions as to the value of our modern civilizations.
I am very glad to hear it, Humphrey, since while there is a spark left, the whole fire may burn up again, and I believe that to the divine mercy there are no limits, though Oro will have a long road to travel before he finds it. And now I have something to say. It has troubled me very much that I was obliged to leave these Orophanans wandering in a kind of religious twilight.
You couldn't help that, said Bickley, seeing that if you had stopped by now you would have been wandering in religious light.
Still, I am not sure that I ought not to have stopped. I seem to have deserted a field that was open to me. However, it can't be helped, since it is certain we could never find that island again, even if Oro has not sunk it beneath the sea, as he is quite capable of doing, to cover his tracks, so to speak. So I mean to do my best in another field by way of atonement.
You are not going to become a missionary, I said.
No, but with the consent of the bishop, who I think believes that my locum got on better in the parish than I do, as no doubt was the case, I too have volunteered for the front, and have been accepted as chaplain of the 201st Division.
Why, that's mine, said Bickley.
Is it? I am very glad, since now we will be able to pursue our pleasant arguments and to do our best to open each other's minds.
You fellows are more fortunate than I am, I remarked. I also volunteered, but they wouldn't take me even as a Tommy, although I misstated my age. They told me, or at least a specialist whom I saw did afterwards, that the blow I got on the head from that sorcerer's boy— I know, broke in Bickley almost roughly. Of course, things might go wrong at any time, but with care you may live to old age. I'm sorry to hear it, I said with a sigh. At least, I think I am. Meanwhile, fortunately, there is much that I can do at home. Indeed, a course of action has been suggested to me by an old friend who is now in authority. Once more, Bickley and Baston in their war-stained uniforms were dining at my table, and on the very night of their return from the front, which was unexpected. Indeed, Tommy nearly died of joy at hearing their voices in the hall. They, who played a worthy part in the great struggle, had much to tell me, and naturally their more recent experiences had overlaid to some extent those which we shared in the mysterious island of Orofena. Indeed, we did not speak of these until, just as they were going away, Baston paused beneath a very beautiful portrait of my late wife, the work of an artist famous for his power of bringing out the inner character, or what some might call the soul, of the sitter. He stared at it for a while in his short-sighted way, then said,
"Do you know, Arbuthnot, it has sometimes occurred to me, and never more than at this moment, that although they were different in height and so on, there was really a curious physical resemblance between your late wife and the Lady Iva."
"Yes," I answered, "I think so too." Bickley also examined the portrait very carefully, and as he did so I saw him start. Then he turned away, saying nothing. Such is the summary of all that has been important in my life. It is, I admit, an odd story, and one which suggests problems that I cannot solve. Baston deals with such things by that acceptance, which is the privilege and hallmark of faith. Bickley disposes, or used to dispose of them, by a blank denial which carries no conviction, and least of all to himself. What is life to most of us who, like Bickley, think ourselves learned? A round, short, but still with time and to spare wherein to be dull and lonesome, a fateful treadmill to which we were condemned we know not how, but apparently through the casual passions of those who went before us, and are now forgotten, causing us, as the Bible says, to be born in sin, up which we walk wearily we know not why, seeming never to make progress, off which we fall out worn we know not when or whither. Such, upon the surface, it appears to be, nor in fact does our ascertained knowledge, as Bickley would sum it up, take us much further. No prophet has yet arisen who attempted to define either the origin or the reasons of life. Even the very greatest of them himself is quite silent on this matter. We are tempted to wonder why. Is it because life, as expressed in the higher of human beings, is, or will be, too vast, too multiform, and too glorious for any definition which we could understand? Is it because in the end it will involve for some, if not for all, majesty on unfathomed majesty, and glory upon unimaginable glory, such as at present far outpass the limits of our thought? The experiences which I have recorded in these pages awaken my heart a hope that this may be so. Baston is wont, like many others, to talk in a light fashion of eternity, without in the least comprehending what he means by that gigantic term. It is not too much to say that eternity, something without beginning and without end, and involving, it would appear, an everlasting changelessness, is a state beyond human comprehension. As a matter of fact, we mortals do not think in constellations, so to speak, or in eons, but by the measure of our own small earth and of our few days thereon. We cannot really conceive of an existence stretching over even 1,000 years, such as that which Oro claimed and the Bible accords to a certain early race of men, omitting, of course, his 2,500 centuries of sleep. And yet, what is this but one grain in the hourglass of time, one day in the lost record of our Earth, of its sisters, the planets, and its father, the Sun, to say nothing of the universes beyond? It is because I have come in touch with a prolonged, though perfectly finite, existence of the sort that I try to pass on the reflections which the fact of it awoke in me. There are other reflections, connected with Iva, and the marvel of her love and its various manifestations, which arise also, but these I keep to myself. They concern the wonder of woman's heart, which is a microcosm of the hopes and fears and desires and despairs of this humanity of ours, whereof, from age to age, she is the mother. Humphrey Arbuthnot. Note by J.R. Bickley, M.R.C.S. Within about 6 months of the date on which he wrote the last words of this history of our joint adventures, my dear friend Humphrey Arbuthnot died suddenly, as I had foreseen that probably he would do, from the results of the injury he received in the island of Orofena. He left me the sole executor to his will, under which he divided his property into three parts. One-third he bequeathed to me, one-third which is strictly tied up to Baston, and one-third to be devoted under my direction to the advancement of science. His end appears to have been instantaneous, resulting from an effusion of blood upon the brain. When I was summoned, I found him lying dead by the writing-desk in his library at Fulcombe Priory. He had been writing at the desk, for on it was a piece of paper on which appear these words, "I have seen her. I..." There the writing ends, not stating whom he thought he had seen in the moments of mental disturbance or delusion which preceded his decease. Save for certain verbal corrections, I publish this manuscript without comment as the will directs, only adding that it sets out our mutual experiences very faithfully, though Arbuthnot's deductions from them are not always my own. I would say also that I am contemplating another visit to the South Sea Islands, where I wish to make some further investigations. I dare say, however, that these will be barren of results, as the fountain of life water is buried forever, nor, as I think, will any human being stand again in the Hades-like halls of Nio. It is probable also that it would prove impossible to rediscover the island of Orofena if indeed that volcanic land still remains above the waters of the deep. Now that he is a very wealthy man, Baston talks of accompanying me for purposes quite different from my own, but on the whole I hope he will abandon this idea. I may add that when he learned of his unexpected inheritance, he talked much of the deceitfulness of riches, but that he has not as yet taken any steps to escape their golden snare. Indeed, he now converses of his added opportunities of usefulness, I gather, in connection with missionary enterprise. J.R. Bickley. P.S. I forgot to state that the spaniel Tommy died within 3 days of his owner. The poor little beast was present in the room at the time of Arbuthnot's passing away, and when found seemed to be suffering from shock. From that moment Tommy refused food and finally was discovered quite dead, and lying by the body on Marama's feather cloak, which Arbuthnot often used as a dressing gown. As Baston raised some religious objections, I arranged without his knowledge that the dog's ashes should rest not far from those of the master and mistress whom it loved so well. J.R.B.
I hope you have enjoyed what you have heard, and I look forward to your comments. Send those cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. The Campaign for Real Mail thanks you. No promises, but there's a good chance I'll read out whatever you send me. If you like these shows enough to support them, and you're not comfortable mailing envelopes full of cash, you can set up a recurring monthly tip for the storyteller at patreon.com/publius_reads.